Managing Violence Podcast, Episode 90. We're talking threat assessment with Dr. James Carwell. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to the Managing Violence Podcast. I'm joined today by an absolute legend, a pioneer in the field of threat assessment, Dr. James Jim Carwood. Dr. Carwood is, as I said, one of the real pioneers in the field of threat assessment. That is the academic study and practical application of looking at someone's behavior and determining whether they are a threat to society, whether they are likely to enact violence upon society or upon others, or even indeed upon themselves. Dr. Carwood was right at the forefront of that movement and is still today actively involved. He has worked on thousands upon thousands upon thousands of active cases of violence, and he is an amazing resource. I'm so honored to have him on the show that I'm not even going to try to sell you anything, but I will say go to patreon.com/managingviolence if you would like to subscribe there to get more content from Dr. Carwood and all our other guests. Also, Dr. Carwood has left the door open to do a part two to this interview, so please do let me know about what topics you would like to cover, what you'd like to see more detail about. He is a wealth of information, and he is eager to share. So without further ado, here is Dr. James Carwood. Dr. Jim Carwood, thank you very much for joining us on the Managing Violence Podcast. It is an honor.
Well, no, it's nice to be invited. I've been a fan. And have learned some stuff from your podcast. So it's nice to be invited and have an opportunity to chat.
I'll take that. I'm going to print out that quote and put it on the wall that I've taught you something. That's amazing. Jim, I've given you background in the show intro, so we won't walk through the many accolades and achievements of your career, or else we literally just won't do anything else for an hour. But I'm really curious. I found the field of threat assessment early on in my career through the work of Gavin De Becker, reading The Gift of Fear, and that kind of was the first introduction I had to this whole idea of the prediction and prevention of violence, and it's something that's fascinated me ever since. And I read that as a young psychology student at the University of Queensland, and that kind of changed a lot of what I was thinking about in terms of my career trajectory and what I wanted to study. But I'm curious for you. I mean, you've been in this field for over 30 years. I'm assuming the field of threat assessment was young or not well known at the time that you ended up down this path. So what was your progression? How did you come across threat assessment and get involved?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, I've been at this so long now, you know, that I kid people that, you know, I was doing workplace violence cases before we even had the term workplace violence. So what ended up happening with me is that I had graduated from UC Berkeley and in ancient Greek political theory, if you can believe it, and decided that I was an action-oriented guy. I had been a martial artist at Berkeley and done some things at the national level there. And so I was looking for some excitement, but I needed a job and I wanted to give back to the community. And so I ended up entering law enforcement. And as I was on the street being a street cop, I realized that coming from Berkeley and having some experiences understanding that there are ways to maybe prevent or try to avoid violence, I was pretty disappointed. This is in the late 70s, early 80s. I was pretty disappointed that law enforcement was all reactive. And of course, that's how it has to be in many cases because of both access to resources as well as what the community expects. But for me, that was not satisfactory at all. And so ultimately, I ended up leaving law enforcement and went into private security, hoping, in essence, to become a private secret service. I saw that as being an opportunity for getting, you know, ahead of and in the prevention area. And actually was at one point was working at the Hotel St. Francis, ended up working with a lot of secret service people because, of course, the President of the United States used to stay there as every time he came to San Francisco. And so I was on the security staff there being former law enforcement and was able to meet the agents. And at the time though, Secret Service agents were paid less than I was as a security officer at the Hotel St. Francis. So that wasn't attractive. And so I started my own company. I ended up starting my own company. And then in the you know, mid 80s, I was introduced to a case involving a situation where a guy had threatened to kill some people. And a friend of mine who was a security consultant at the time had been doing some work for this think tank in the Bay Area and basically said, they said, look, can you, you know, this guy's, you know, making threats to kill people. We don't know what to do. We've called law enforcement. They said, you know, call us when something happens. Do you have any way of managing this? And my friend's comment, and this is absolutely a true story. I mean, my friend's comment to them was, you know, I don't know anyone who does that right now, but I know a guy crazy enough to try it. So they ended up calling me and we put together a team of a protection team and went in and did some standby when they terminated this guy. And the guy came back the next day and with a 38 handgun and attempted to kill people. And we ended up stopping him from doing that, chased him off. Eventually he was arrested in the community and served time in prison. But that for me was an epiphany moment. I'm like, well, wait a minute. I want to get ahead of this. And I got the chance to do it. Why aren't I learning more about it? And so I began to explore this idea of John Monahan and a number of other thinkers in the academic side had begun to explore around what they called at the time dangerousness assessment, violence risk assessment. It became violence risk assessment or violence assessment, and began to, you know, it obviously very academic and very nascent, very, you know, thoughtful and theoretical, but not very deep yet in terms of our understandings of what we could or could not do. And of course, a lot of it was based on work that was being done in the courts. You know, when you go really back into the history of mental health and what people have been doing back as far as the alienists, you know, we call them psychiatrists now, but actually originally they were called alienists, which is in and of itself interesting. The courts had from the, you know, mid to late 1800s had, and in England and in the United States had been asking psychiatrists and others to pontificate about whether or not someone was going to be dangerous in the community. But they were doing it strictly by flying by the seat of their pants and what their, you know, intuition was. And of course, John Monahan was building off this and trying to make it more scientific, more empirical. And so that was kind of the very beginning. And so I got fascinated with the literature. And then I happened to be lucky enough to be in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. And of course, there were two doctors, two psychologists that were at the time working in this area too and very interested. And one was Stephen White, who's still around and one of the co-creators of the Waiver 21, and a guy named Chris Hatcher. And Chris was the police psychologist for San Francisco Police. And they were starting to do some nascent work in this area too. And of course we had the One Market Plaza shooting in San Francisco involving Ricky Katawe, who was a domestic violence perpetrator who went into an office building in downtown San Francisco and shot people up, including his aggrieved spouse. And so Chris had gotten involved in that case, Chris Hatcher, Dr. Hatcher and Steve White. And in terms of unraveling that, what did that case mean? And so I ended up meeting them because, you know, there were very few people doing what I was doing on the security side at the time and the investigation side to feed assessments. And they were very few people doing the assessment side out in the wild, away from correctional institutions or prisons or other, you know, mental health facilities. And so, you know, we ended up getting called into similar cases like 3 and 4 times in a row where I'd get called in on the security side and the investigation side. They got called in from the psych side to do the assessment side. And we just, after running into each other 3 or 4 times, we just said, you know, maybe we ought to like collaborate. And so we actually became much more formally connected as associates. We began to drive a model that was really the first model for multidisciplinary teams doing this kind of work out in the community and certainly in organizational settings, meaning schools and, you know, workplaces and other places. And so we kind of were the first team to kind of grow up and do that across different disciplines. And so we worked together throughout the 80s into the early 90s. And then Chris and Steve broke up, went their own ways. And at that time I'd gotten so fascinated with the assessment aspect of it, not just the security aspect, not just putting in protection teams and doing the backgrounds and all that stuff, but actually doing the behavioral stuff, that I began to explore, really getting much deeper into this psychology side and the behavioral side, and ultimately did go to graduate school in forensic psychology and got my doctorate in psychology, but really became very interested in that. And then, of course, about that same time in the early 90s, the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals was beginning to be stood up in Los Angeles with the LAPD threat management team out of the Rebecca Schaefer shooting. And that began to grow with John Lane and his group down there. And of course, Gavin DeBecker was a part of that. You know, Gavin had been doing some early white papers on the issue. And so, you know, he was, you know, a part of that early formation of ATAP. I think I was the 86th member. They had one chapter in the entire world, and you had to fly to LA. Well, you had to come to half the meetings a year, and there were six meetings a year, or you wouldn't be able to maintain your membership, because it was all about relationships. So I literally had to fly to LA three times a year at a minimum to maintain my membership. But of course, that has now grown into a large national organization, international organization. And of course, now we have KTAP, and we have the Association, European Association, and we have the the Asian Pacific Association. And now we have an association in Africa and an association in South America. So ATAPs have spread. So anyway, so that's kind of my journey. And of course, I average a new case a day, every day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year, and have since the late 80s. Wow. And so, you know, a lot of caseload. I stopped counting years ago, around 5,000 cases. So I just do this all the time. And I do it for federal agencies and state agencies and public and private corporations and post-secondary and whoever else needs the help. So anyway, that's my story. But I love it in the sense that it's so multidisciplinary. There's so much to learn. There's never something you don't learn that eventually is going to become relevant somewhere. You know, whether or not it's going to be HR stuff or the legal stuff, and the security, continuing development of security issues as well as exposures. Of course, all the behavioral stuff we're learning, team dynamics for interdisciplinary teams, and so anyway, so I'll stop there. But it's been a very interesting ride, and still enjoying the heck out of it.
Yeah, that's incredible. There's a lot to that we could unpack there, but we would miss the point of the actual episode that we'd planned out. So I'll resist the urge to go down tangents in that area. I think one thing that I do want to clarify, and I'm sure listeners who've got this far have already realized, but I just want to spell it out. Sometimes when we get someone on the show with a PhD. People assume that their knowledge is coming from academic or research base, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it is sometimes assumed that it comes at a deficit of actual practical experience. And that's certainly not your case. I mean, as you've mentioned, more than 5,000 cases of actual violence, thousands upon thousands of interactions with the prevention and I guess response to real violent incidents. So everything that we're going to cover does it not only stand up to academic rigor, but it is informed by practical experience. So we've got a very unique situation here to learn from someone who has not only been there, done that, but also has understood the best practice and best ways of getting there, not just through practical experience, but also through academic rigor. So I just want to make that very clear before we move forward, before anyone dismisses anything because of any bias or prejudice they may have.
So. Well, you know, and it's interesting you say that, and that's very kind of you to say, and it is true. But, you know, first of all, the cases aren't, they're violence related or violence concerning cases. Not all of them led to violence, because obviously the process is successful. But I think the other thing that's really important is that, you know, to let you know that that's one of the reasons why I went back to and got an academic grounding in this. In other words, I realized that I love the practical, the hands-on, the ability to really do the work, sit in the room with the people that are destabilized and of concern, and really be willing to go face to face with them and learn from them, and to connect with them and obviously try to influence them, which is not the case in many of these types of situations. There's a lot of people out there doing violence risk assessment, and we'll talk about the difference between that threat assessment, that are more than happy to have them come visit an office in a very sterile space, or they're more than happy to do some kind of analysis inside a locked ward or inside a prison cell. but aren't really willing to go out and deal with the dynamics that go on in a community when someone's uncontained and could actually just leave the room and decide to do something violent. And that's the part that I realized that there was a certain point where there needed to be people that were willing to cross over and do both. And of course, Stephen White, Dr. Hatcher, you know, and some others in the field that do this work. You know, I think of Steve Hart out of British Columbia, and certainly a number of other people with an academic background to a certain degree are willing to do that. But that's pretty rare. Most of the people that are theoreticians don't go face to face. And I don't, I'll be blunt. I don't really respect people that aren't willing to go face to face. If you're not, if you're doing the work, you got to get in the room. You got to be willing to put yourself at risk if that's what the job takes, because that's the best assessment you can do. And so, you know, I wanted the academic background to support my opinions and to learn more about things. But really it is, I value a great deal the men and women that put themselves on the line, every day. And that's who we should really be helping the most. Right.
There's a phrase I stole a little while ago. I wish I could remember exactly who I got it from, but I love it. The idea was that we need more practitioner academics, those that have been there, done that.
Yes.
They also know why they did it. And the term that I stole was pracademic. We need more. Yeah.
There you go. And I totally agree with you. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Yep.
I'm not sure if you've come across the Institute of Strategic Risk Management, which was stood up a couple of years ago by Dr. David Rubens in the UK, but I'm the vice chair for Australia and New Zealand. And the whole premise of the Institute of Strategic Risk Management was to create a platform where practitioners, academics, and policymakers could get together in the same room and actually hash out difficult problems when it comes to strategic risk. And and the idea that we've sort of, or the value that we've found is that oftentimes practitioners know what works because they've done it over and over and over, but they perhaps can't articulate why it works, or they can't really, a lot of it is, well, I just know because of experience. Well, that's not always easy to impart on someone until they have the experience. And then we've got academics that might have a good idea or might have a theory about why something should work, but they've never actually applied it. So therefore, they may not know what actually happens in the real world when you try this thing. And then you've got policymakers who are paid to make decisions about something they have no experience with nor no understanding of. So sometimes they need to listen to both sides. So that's the whole genesis of the ISRM. And I think it's very akin to what you're just saying there about the importance of understanding both worlds.
And the importance of multidisciplinary teams in this work. I mean, the fact is that you need all those different perspectives, and it's going to be the wisdom of crowds that's going to get us to the best outcomes, right? It's not going to be one individual view or one individual core competency. Now, there are people like myself that bridge a couple core competencies in this area, and we're getting more of those, and I would like to train more of those. I've got a guy I'm working with right now who's getting his doctorate in clinical psychology, but he's also training in security, in-depth security, and reading the POA manual, the Protection of Assets manual of the ASIS International and ASIS International. And so, you know, he's going to be cross-trained, and that's the kind of thing we need to start moving to. It's going to be going beyond just having multidisciplinary teams, but everyone stays in their general lane except in discussion. And we're going to start seeing, I think, more effectively multi-talented, multi-dimensional people joining multidisciplinary teams to get even deeper into that cross collaboration in depth. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I think that's where we're headed. So I'm excited about that as well, because I think, you know, it's in my work that I do when I'm talking to clients. In fact, in this case, I'm working in New Zealand right now. The fact is that ability to have communication with a client where you can competently not only talk about the assessment, not only talk about the behavior, but also talk about organizational dynamics and the communications of the results and what to do about security and how to deal with victims' anxiety. I mean, that ability to competently cover all of those different topics, both from a theoretical as well as from a practical perspective, having done the work, is really, I think, the highest, is the goal we all are continuing to strive for. to have that level of mastery. You know, they used to say that, you know, you know a lot, but you're a master of none, right? Mm-hmm. And actually that's no longer going to be competent. You actually are going to have to become a master of several. Mm. And I think that's the, and then of course that just means a great dedication. I mean, you know, I have a tendency, you know, and over the years, right, you have to read all the time, as I'm sure you do. You have to read from multiple different sources, you have and a variety of different topics, and that's a lot of work. But if you're passionate about it, I think that's the way to go. But anyway, we're all a little off topic, but not really. I mean, I think, you know, where this field's headed is going to be those kinds of more in-depth expectations, as well as necessary to be able to deliver that level of support to our clients. So,
absolutely. Anyway. So as a starting point, I think it's always good to start by defining terms. Yep. You mentioned there's a difference between threat assessment or the threat assessment and violence risk assessment are two different things. Could you just expand upon that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So this has evolved over time, but here's the thing. There's a new edition of the International Handbook of Threat Assessment that just came out just literally months ago. And Reed Malloy led that with Jens. And it's a huge lift. I mean, it's a huge book and collaborators from all over the world. But they say it very well. And so I'm going to borrow from them in terms of the differentiation. When you're looking at threat assessment, you're looking at the process of assessing the probability of the risk of violence, usually with an uncontained individual. This process is done by multiple background individuals with adequate training, in other words, HR, security, law enforcement, mental health professionals, and others, with the goal of protecting, primarily focused on the goal of protecting the victims and dealing with the management and the de-escalation and influence of the individual not to continue on the pathway to violence. And because they're uncontained, they have, of course, the ability, as I talked about earlier, to act out immediately. And so there's this need for practical addressing, triage, and management that is community and victim focused. Violence risk assessment is a whole nother animal. Violence risk assessment is done. So threat assessment is an operational process. Violence risk assessment is actually a judicial and regulatory process, only done by licensed mental health professionals, usually done in the context of a request from a court or other regulatory agency to assess an individual who's in some form of containment, mental health containment or prison containment or other related, being reviewed for some other kinds of structure, and is focused on the individual's level of risk to a wide range of targets, not just singular targets for targeted violence, and is made for the around the decision of whether or not release or other conditions will be placed on them. And the difference, there's a huge difference in both the complexity of those two different things, but also the access to resources and the time frame. So if I'm doing a violence risk assessment and the person's sitting in a mental health institution, or he's sitting in jail, or he's sitting somewhere else that he's in containment, I have time in the world to, you know, I've got subpoena power, I've got judges saying you've got to release your medical records, I got all sorts of stuff to do that allows me a chance to kind of postulate about this guy or gal and, you know, what's going to happen with them and what they might do, and, you know, then deliver that opinion to the court, and then the court or others, triers of fact, decide what to do. If I'm doing threat assessment, it's much more dynamic. Amount of information I may get, given my clients or given who else is involved, given privacy considerations, given legal considerations, is going to be wildly different. I'm rarely going to have access to subpoena power in terms of being, and I'm rarely going to have access to the unlimited amount of time to make these decisions and actually start to implement management and intervention. And so it's going to be a much more difficult process and a much more, what we call in the mental health community, a much more heterogeneous process, meaning a much more varied process. I mean, all over the place, right? Mm. So those are two wildly different things. And what we do in the larger world, who vast majority of people are going to be involved in threat assessment. They're not going to be involved in violence risk because A, they don't have the formal mental health background and degrees and other things and licensing to do that. And they won't be called on the courts and regulatory bodies. And so that both opens up the field to a larger number of practitioners, but it also opens up the complexity of what those practitioners are going to have to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really thorough explanation. I appreciate that. So focusing on threat assessment, we were discussing offline in the lead up to this interview what sort of things we could talk about. And I would love to do a whole season with you and sort of pick your brain about various subjects and get free tuition. But for the sake of focusing your conversation and I guess laying the groundwork, I probably mentioned in the intro that my hope is that we'll do a second, maybe even a third show, depending on the feedback from this one as to what people want to learn more about. But with this show, let's lay the framework of what is your process for doing a threat assessment? So you've been called in compliant. I'll let you sort of paint the picture of whatever you want to talk about in terms of what you look for to get started and how you work through this process.
Sure. So let me first, let me lay a little bit of groundwork because I want to be sure that we get off on the right foot and the audience understands a couple of things. Because you and I also had a sidebar in our emails about this idea of prediction. Mm-hmm. So let me just be really clear. Threat assessment and threat management is not about the prediction of violence. It is absolutely impossible to predict whether or not someone will be violent or not. And you realize that that's really a binary question, yes or no, right? They're either going to do it or they're not going to do it. The problem is that there's no way on an individualized basis that you're ever going to know that for a fact, ever. We don't predict violence. What we do is we look at understanding risk probability for violence in the low, moderate, or high risk category. And on the other side of high risk, it's called, let's call emergency services in the community right now and lock down the facility because someone's coming with weapons, right? So it's probabilities. And what that really means, though, and it's important to understand the difference, is that so when I'm doing an assessment of an individual, I'm not saying they will or will not commit an act of violence. I'm saying what's the probability that an individual, given their behavioral, current behavioral expressions, given their current way of thinking, given their current access to weapons, given the current destabilizers and protective factors that are involved in that person's life and their perception of them, they are going to use violence to achieve their goal. And so that's really what we're doing here. And so it's a biopsychosocial, contextual, and environmental assessment and management process. And you know, I've written about this, obviously, in the third edition of my co-authored book with Mike Corcoran, Dr. Michael Corcoran, former Secret Service and law enforcement guy, too, who, you know, has his doctorate. And, you know, we've written about this kind of extensively. But with that as framing, let's talk about kind of how a case flows. So, you know, I literally get a call. I mean, it's just like everyone else, right? So I'll get a call. I got one. I got two yesterday, actually. But, you know, I got a call and the guy says, you know, let me tell you what's going on. I heard that I should call you because, you know, I've got three employees who say that this guy has threatened them. And, you know, I don't know how worried I should be, as an example. And I specialize in organizational violence. And what that means is that I specialize in cases involving institutions or organizations, whether or not it's federal or state or local institutions like courts or departments, or whether or not it's so public agency stuff, or whether or not it's post-secondary, I mean, universities, colleges, and others, or schools or businesses. But it's going to be around that kind of environment. In other words, either someone is a participant in that environment, meaning they're a student or an employee or something, or the threatener is related, or the person of concern is related to that a person inside one of those organizations. And so I get retained by the organizations for that purpose. And so that's how I get involved. And the reason why I do that is, and I'll be blunt, is because individual clients are rarely controllable. When you start working for individuals, they have a tendency to go their own way and they'll listen to your advice and then they'll go off and do whatever they want to do. If they're assigned to an organization, by as an employee or have other related connections, then we usually have more ability to influence their behavior. And victimology, as you know, because you're obviously very well steeped in this field, you understand that any kind of situation that could involve violence is going to involve both the perpetrator and, of course, then their dynamic relationship with their victim or victim population. Mm-hmm. And it's that contextual dynamic that actually leads to or de-escalates the possibility of violence. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So in many cases, the first thing we can have some influence over is the victim and how they are managing their own behavior, as we're also trying to understand now the person of concern and how then to use that information to influence their behavior. And so ultimately, I get this call. So really what it boils down to is I just start listening. I mean, it's very much a listening function. So tell me what's going on. Tell me what's happened. Tell me what the person said. And I begin to do triage, looking for these biopsychosocial, contextual, and environmental risk factors that I know and have been trained to see that would escalate the risk around violence or de-escalate the risk around violence. I mean, one of the things that people don't look at when they're doing this kind of triage, and of course, you have to do a first case triage, because the first case triage, Joe, is do I need you to hang up the phone right now and call the police, right? So I had a case involving a situation where a church, of a particular faith called me and they said, I need to know whether or not this person is dangerous. They just showed up and they have a package and they're waiting to see me and they're in the outer office. And, I don't know what to do. I said, why are you calling me? And they said, well, about 2 weeks ago, we got a call from another caller who said that this person was telling them that they wanted to bring a bomb to my office and kill me. And now this person's here with a bag and I don't know what to do. And I said, hang up the phone and call the police right now and evacuate the building. And they said, no, what should I really do? And I said, no, hang up the phone, call the police and evacuate the building right now. There's nothing else that I can do for you. I don't know what's in the bag. And it sounds to me like we should try to address that first, right? So this is not a time for great assessment, right? This is triage. Just, get it done, man. Well, it turns out the bag was full of dog poop, which was good because it took the police 25 minutes to get there. So if it had been a real bomb, I'm sure that there would have been a lot of instruction. But the point remains is that you first do that triage. And obviously that's what I'm listening for. I'm listening for those immediate concerns. But often it's not the case because Joe, you and I both know that often they don't call you for days or weeks after the incident of concerns has been reported to them. And it kind of matriculates through the organization. And eventually someone says, maybe we ought to call someone about this. And so ultimately, it's rarely going to be an emergency, right?
I'm going to wait for the next budget cycle.
So, it's rarely going to be an emergency. But you have to be aware of that. So once you do that initial triage assessment about immediate risk, right, we call it the initial assessment, then you start the engagement process. So, what else do we need to do? What other information do we need to have? What's your interview pool? And this is all an information-driven process, but it goes deeper than just looking at records. You're looking for the behaviors that are existing in that record that then give you some insight into what might be the reasons why those behaviors are happening, which leads you back to personality or biological or sociological related factors that are driving that behavior. In other words, first we feel things and think things, and those feelings and thoughts lead to actions. But if I can look at someone's actions, I can do a kind of a backtrace, if you will, into these thoughts and feelings, and now have a better understanding of strategically how that person's viewing the world, how they perceive the world. And that perception of how they perceive the world is critical to being able to then interact with them to try to determine if there are ways that we can agree that they will be able to reach their goals without having to use violence to reach them. Hmm. The ultimate gold standard in this work, Joe, is to get a person to willingly choose from their own perception of reality, not to commit a violent act against your protectees, because they no longer personally see it as being a way that they can long-term achieve their goals. If you can get them to make that decision, or I should say help them, influence them to make that decision, then you don't have to worry about them being in the supermarket next week. You don't have to worry about the fact they're going to get out of jail in 2 weeks. You don't have to worry about the fact that they're going to get out of that mental institution a year from now. Yeah. Because ultimately, all those other means that we have of externally controlling people, arrest, mental health commitments, all this other stuff, are all just momentary stabilization devices. They're not long-term fixes. And they get out of prison, they get out of jail, they get out of these mental institutions. And of course, what do? They're angry, they're upset, and if they're still fixated, they come at you again. But now they come at you again in a much more educated way. And that's really not in anyone's best interest, particularly for long-term safety. And I'm looking for long-term safety. I'm not just looking to immediately avoid, which would be, I do want to immediately avoid violence, don't misunderstand me, but that's not the long-term goal of threat assessment. The long-term goal of threat assessment is to have the long-term change in perception that leads these protectees to be safe.
I really love it. You just so eloquently stated, man, getting the person to see through their own filter, through their own worldview, why this isn't the best course of action for them, not because right. I'm wrong or because there's punishment or because there's some sort of looming sword over their head if they do this, but because it doesn't achieve their aims anymore. We can apply that to so many different areas of violence, whether we're talking about domestic and family violence, we're talking about terrorism or anything in between.
Right.
Getting the person to choose that this isn't going to achieve what I wanted to achieve, and there's a better way to do that. That's, as you said, it's the gold standard. But you've just stated it so eloquently there. I've just scribbled down some notes on that because I think that's probably the shortest and most succinct way of explaining that concept I've ever heard. So I appreciate that.
Well, you're welcome. But I mean, I think that, you know, all of us have kind of come to that over time. But I think it's critical that it's. That people really do own that and understand that, because it's not singing kumbaya. I mean, I think one of the things that's really in America, kumbaya is kind of a generally, you know, we're all kind of hippie groovy kind of people, right? And that's kind of what it means in America if you're singing kumbaya. And that's not at all what I mean. I mean, in other words, certainly if I can help the person have a better quality of life as a part of this process, and that leads to more long-term stability, then that's awesome. But the fact is that that's not what this is about. All we're trying to do here is get them, as I just talked about, below threshold to act. They decide not to do it. It doesn't mean they're happy. It doesn't mean they're still not angry. It doesn't mean they still don't believe that they've been mistreated. They just don't choose to act violently as a means to seek redress.
Yeah.
And that's really all we're doing, just below threshold.
Yeah, and we need to understand their worldview to have any idea how to even approach that. And I think sometimes one of the weaknesses I see when less informed practitioners try to go down this path of threat assessment is that they immediately other the perpetrator. They immediately say, well, he's a sociopath or he's a psychopath or he's a whatever. Right? They put some label on them, which immediately puts a mental block between being able to understand their motivations and who they are as a human being and why they're doing the things they're doing. Rather than just looking at, yeah, maybe someone is a psychopath, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're unreasonable. It doesn't necessarily mean there aren't things we can do to influence them.
And that's exactly right. That's very wise. And here's the thing. I mean, this, you're so right on, because I deal with cases where people are wildly and actively psychotic. I mean, I'm talking about, when I say psychotic, I mean, they're experiencing all-encompassing delusions, falsely held beliefs held in contravention, all known evidence, or they're experiencing full-blown hallucinations. I mean, we're talking Russell Crowe, beautiful mind, right? Hallucinations. You can still reach them. You can still understand how they're viewing the world. You can still influence how they view the world. They still have a worldview. They still are acting out of that worldview. Mm-hmm. And so what you said was so wise there, Joe, because the fact is that I labeling someone does you zero good in terms of having it practically help you.
I think what it does is it absolves the labeler of any onus on having control over the situation. I think when we say, oh, I couldn't possibly have done something about that because of this person's XYZ condition or because of the way they conducted themselves, they're not like me, therefore I had no responsibility to change anything about the situation. Whereas it's a scapegoat most of the time.
Well, I think it can be. I think it can be. I think it also, you know, as you said, it's a way of building in an excuse if it doesn't go well.
Yeah.
It's not just absolving them immediately, but it helps kind of lay the groundwork that if they need absolution, right, they can do it.
Yep.
Right. They can have it. Yeah. So I agree. So we gather all this information together. So I guess, you know, get a little bit back on topic, right? We're gathering all this information from the interviews. We do have to understand how to do in-depth background investigations and public records and what the privacy considerations are. And we have to know how to do effective interviews. There's a whole process of interviewing. I just wrote a book that came out at the end of last year in Academic Press on threat and violence assessment interventions, effective influence. And I talk in there in depth about taking enhanced cognitive interviewing, which I'm sure you've heard of and many of your listeners have as well, and fusing it with the foundation of motivational interviewing to be able to do these kinds of interviews, in-depth interviews with victims and witnesses and persons of concern, to really be able to draw out of those interviews and those interactions the biological and sociological and psychological information that I'm going to need to be able to understand their worldview and have them feel heard, have them feel as if I truly do understand and have paid attention. And therefore, when I begin to ask them questions about what they want to do and how they plan to do it and how that aligns with what it is they've told me that's important to them, they begin to understand as much the same as some motivational interviewing contexts, that maybe what they're trying to do isn't aligned with what they want to have happen and isn't going to give them that. And then we literally begin to collaborate about what other things might be possible. And they may become interested in this. And this all happens within, unlike therapy where you've got, you know, 7 sessions, I get one shot, right? I get an hour, I get 2 hours, I may be up to 4 hours with a person of concern, right? So you're doing not only assessment portion of the interview, but you're starting to do an influence portion of the interview all within that one shot period of time. And that's all you get. Mm-hmm. And again, this is different than violence risk assessment, where they can possibly have 2 or 3 or 4 sessions with a guy sitting in jail or a gal sitting in a mental institution. You know, you get one shot in this work, if you get one shot at all, right? If they're even willing to talk to you, because you can't compel them to talk to you.
Yeah. And so to build long-term rapport or anything like that,
you've
got to do it in one hit.
Yeah. That's right. And I think that's right. And so there's a whole art to that too. That's a whole nother conversation. But then you gather all this information together. And the point is that you gathered all information together. And now, unlike the early days, you know, there are tools, what we call violence risk assessment tools or structured professional judgment tools. And the term's going to have to change because obviously these tools are now being used obviously in threat assessment as well. So maybe I should just say violence assessment tools rather than violence risk assessment tools. Or risk of violence assessment tools, structured professional judgment that have been normed. So, you know, my doctoral dissertation was taking the HCR 20 version 3. Many of your listeners will know what that is. You know, the historical, clinical, and risk tool, and looking at an organizational population. No one had ever tested the HCR 20 version 3 against an organizational population. It had always been tested against a correctional or a mental health population. So could this really do the work in general populations where the people aren't necessarily mentally ill, mm-hmm. Aren't necessarily incarcerated? And the answer was, yeah, it does a decent job. And of course, then we also tested, and I've got the just coming out with the Journal of Threat Assessment and Management, which I would encourage all of your listeners to subscribe to. American Psychological Association has a multidisciplinary journal called the Journal of Threat Assessment and Management. It's going to come out with articles that also then compare my grid system that I originally co-developed with Dr. Stephen White and the HCR 20 version 3 and the waiver 21 against that same sample. And it turns out that we're all pretty good at this, but they're the only ones that have been tested against this kind of general population. So you want to have a tool that's been validated and appropriately grounded in the science to help make sure that individual assessors are not doing making major errors based on their gut reaction or their assumptions of who's who's possibly more risky than others, and then using that as a platform to then make some final assessment about what the level of risk is. And of course, because you've gathered all that information and you put it in chronologies and you've been able to now use a tool to help kind of sort out where your gaps are and where your strengths are in terms of the data you have and the behavioral have, now you can begin to do this risk formulation that case formulation that Steve Hart talks about in terms of making some projections, some theories. Okay, so if this guy or gal thinks this way, if this is our way that they predominantly we believe they view the world, if these kinds of future events happen or we set in motion through response and intervention these types of events to happen, what's their most likely reaction going to be? What would happen if they accelerated only on a low risk trajectory? What would they most likely do if they were doing a moderate risk trajectory? What would happen if we stimulated them and they went high risk all of a sudden? What would that look like? Because people have a tendency to do something similar and build off something similar to the one they've done before, then to create a new behavior. This is why we have habits. Anything as a species, anything that we do brand new is dangerous and could kill us.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason why we dress slightly differently as we develop, we take slightly separate routes to work, we do other things that are extensions and evolutions rather than revolutions in behavior, is because anything new could kill us. And whether or not that's really true or whether or not it's just our ancient brain being attentive to it because that's how we're still wired, doesn't really matter. The fact is we get anxious when we do semi-new things, and even dangerous people do, even people that are committing violence do. And so ultimately, what would be most likely that they would do? And then how do we then both put in place the necessary, if necessary, protections to thwart that capability while we're interacting with that individual and trying to get them, as we talked about, to willingly choose to not even try to approach and harm. And so that's really the process, if you will, of threat assessment and then using that information for development of possible futures and then to use that as a springboard for both response and for intervention. And those are different things. I just to be clear. Responses are things that we do coming out of an assessment, a threshold assessment to be able to extend the assessment and maybe more interviews, maybe background investigation, more file work, maybe more engaging with law enforcement, doing other things that we have no reasonable belief that the individual of concern will have any knowledge of. So when we're responding to a case, we're developing structures, frameworks, information, and other things to further our depth of understanding of what's going on and to begin to put in place the frameworks for managing. When we're doing interventions are things that actually are going to directly or indirectly touch on that person of concern with the explicit intent of actually beginning to influence their behavior. We talked about the interview as an example, being both an assessment piece at the beginning and then an influence piece on the backside while we're still sitting together. But of course, then if you look at restraining orders or you look at no trespass orders or you look at law enforcement going to the house for a check-in on their well-being, or you're looking at other related processes, all of those are attempts to influence that person's behavior. And of course, as we talked about, the more harsh ones are going to be momentary and could be escalating. So you want to be very careful with those. And we much prefer to use the more softer and the less intrusive versions to begin with, if we can, given the case. But that's so very important to differentiate between responses and interventions, if you say, and they're not the same thing, but all of them fall under the rubric of case management. So yeah. I'll stop there, but does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, and I mean, there are so many topics within that that we could expand upon, and so I'd like to encourage listeners that have, as you'll know, we're getting close to the end of the episode. And you're probably thinking, I want to know more about this, and this. Please leave comments wherever you're listening to this, or on our Facebook group, or email me. And let me know what you'd like to hear more about, because I really want to get Jim back again. But we want to know what you want to know more about, so that we can focus the conversation in that direction. So if you are disappointed that you're seeing the hour come up and you're realizing that we haven't gone into the topic you want to talk about, fear not, because we will get there. And even if we end up doing just a Q&A episode with 20 different topics, then so be it. We'll make it happen. Jim, I just want to give you a bit of a platform to talk about what you actually do and talk about Factor One just before we close.
Sure. I mean, what we do is exactly what we just talked about. I mean, we're a threat assessment and management firm. That's all we do. You know, we certainly have the investigative background and the security background as well as the behavioral background. But yeah, I mean, I literally just work cases. You know, I used to have a much bigger organization and I realized that I just don't like managing people. I like doing work. And so we've kept it pretty small. And I like working cases and I've got good people working with me. And then when I need to collaborate, I've got great associates that I can work with. So I've got reach all over the world to be able to do the work I need to do. And with other colleagues, both from a lot from the TAPS, mm-hmm. from the threat assessment associations people I've met through there. That's all we do. So if you've got a need and someone is making you uncomfortable or scaring you, or you don't know, you know, what kind of risk they may pose, then, you know, shoot me an email, give me a call. I mean, it's what I do. So again, though, I specialize in organizations, so not individual cases. And I just want to be really clear about that. So don't send me a concern that your neighbor's a problem. That's really not probably going to be something I'll be able to respond to.
All right. Thank you very much, Jim. It's been fantastic having this interview. You're going to stick around and do some bonus questions with us in just a minute. But those that are leaving us here, I just want to thank you once again for making yourself available. You're a luminary in the field, and it's great to sit under the learning tree for an hour and hear from you. So thank you on behalf of everybody for sharing your knowledge with us.
No, you're welcome, and thanks for inviting me.
Thanks once again to Dr. James Carwood for making himself available to talk about his area of expertise, where he is one of the world's leading experts, and that is threat assessment. Please do let us know what you would like to hear more about from Jim. He is an amazing wealth of knowledge. You will not find too many people on the planet that understand violence better than he does. So make sure you take advantage of that opportunity and let me know what you want me to talk to Jim about next. It'll be an amazing opportunity that won't come up again. All right, that's about it. Make sure you head on over to patreon.com/managing violence. Go to Amazon, buy my book, Neon Jungle, The Bouncer's True Tales of Lessons, Laughs, and Lacerations, or go to violencepod.com if you'd like a signed copy. That's it. I'll talk to you again next time.